think the school shootings will ever end? I was getting ready, working on my sermon on Friday, when I got a news alert on my computer that said there was a California school in lockdown as there was a report of an active shooter. And I never really heard too many of the details, but it just kind of got me thinking, have we always had school shootings? And so I thought I would do a little reading, and I found out that the very first United States shooting took place in 1764. It was even before we were a nation. There was a shooting at a school, and in fact, you can find shootings in the 1800s, the 1900s, but it just seems like they've intensified. The first real mass shooting that I can remember took place in the last part of the 90s. It was in Littleton, Colorado, as two students decided they wanted to kill as many of their fellow students as possible. My guess is that you remember some of those days coming out of Columbine, and many things came out of it, but one of the things that, I don't know if you saw this or not, but there was a poem. It was originally attributed to one of the survivors, but it actually was written by a pastor in Seattle, and I wanted to read just a little bit of it. He calls it the paradox of our time. He says, the paradox of our time in history is that we have taller buildings, but shorter tempers, wider freeways, but narrower viewpoints. We spend more, but have less. We buy more, but enjoy it less. These are the days of two incomes, but more divorces. Of fancier houses, but broken homes. These are the times of world peace, but domestic warfare. More leisure, but less fun. More kinds of food, but less nutrition. We write more, but learn less. We plan more, but accomplish less. We've learned to rush, but not to wait. We have higher incomes, but lower morals. We have more food, but less appeasement. We build more computers to hold more information, to produce more copies than ever, but have less communication. We've become long on quantity, but short on quality. We've cleaned up the air, but polluted the soul. We've split the atom, but not our prejudice. We've been all the way to the moon and back, but have trouble crossing the street to meet the new neighbor. We have multiplied our possessions but reduce our values. We talk too much. We love too seldom. We hate too often. We've learned how to make a living but not a life. We've added years to life, not life to years. We drink too much, smoke too much, spend too recklessly, laugh too little, drive too fast, get angry too quickly, stay up too late, get up too tired, read too seldom, watch TV too much, and pray too seldom. We have bigger houses and smaller families, more convenience, but less time. We have more degrees, but less sense. It's a time when there is much in the showroom and nothing in the stockroom. A time when technology has brought this letter to you, and a time when you can choose either to make a difference or just hit the delete key. I don't know your views this morning, but I'm guessing some of us might wonder, is there any hope anymore? Well, I can confidently tell you the hope is not found in Washington, D.C. It's not to suggest that politics are irrelevant, but politicians can't provide hope. Neither can education or the economy. Where can we find hope? Well, as we're going through our 66 books, looking at one book each week, I was shocked this week how the book of 2 Chronicles deals with where America is. Because you will find that the only hope Israel, or in this case Judah, ever had was revival. Let me, if I could, just kind of set it where we were last week. I shared that the book of Chronicles in the English Bible follows the books of Samuel and Kings. We've divided all three of them up into two, but in the Hebrew Bible, it really isn't just simply a repetition. In fact, in the Hebrew Bible, it really plays a completely different role. It's not following Kings. It's actually the very last book in the entire Old Testament. And in many ways, it serves to be a summary of all that's happened. It begins with the very word Adam. And it ends as the nation of Israel is returning back from their captivity, looking for a hope. In fact, the book of Chronicles is really going to provide this overview that there is hope, but only when found in the Lord. The books of Chronicles, we've divided them up into two different books. I would suggest there's really four major sections. The first is that boring section, that list of names, but it's really not an exhaustive list. In fact, if you take time to read through it, you'll see that the author picks and chooses his name, and he does so focusing around two primary themes. The first is going to be the Davidic kingdom. He goes and he emphasizes the tribe of Judah and eventually David because he wants us to look forward not to David's kingship, but to the king in the line of David that's coming. But the second major theme, in fact, the one that you will see throughout the book, is the importance of worship, and specifically the worship that transpires at the temple. And thus, the line of Aaron becomes this priority. And in fact, as you come to the last section of the First Chronicles, when we looked last week, we saw that the primary emphasis on David was not what Samuel shares. I mean, as you read through it, there's a number of stories. I would suggest the pivotal chapter in 1 Samuel is chapter 16, when David is faced to answer the question, will I look on the external or the heart? Because standing before him is Goliath. Chronicles doesn't even mention Goliath. In fact, it really doesn't mention hardly any of David's great victories. It also doesn't mention David's wilderness wanderings. Most of the Psalms, as we'll get there in a few months, are going to be written, or at least many of them are written during this time that David's running for his life. But Chronicles doesn't mention it all. In fact, maybe the most interesting part that is left out is there's no mention of Bathsheba. No mention of David's lust, no mention of his murder of his wife or her husband. It's just gone. Why? Because what is focused on in David is not just that he becomes king, but that he prepares to build a temple. If you come to 1 Kings and you begin to read the story of the building of the temple, you might get the impression that Solomon just built whatever he wanted. It was kind of, oh, this sounds good. It wasn't like Moses back in the previous time, the Pentateuch, that he has all of these instructions from God. No, Solomon just builds what he wants. Well, Chronicles helps us understand that that's not the case. In fact, in many ways, David becomes a new Moses, because God gives him very specific commands as to exactly what the temple should look like. And thus, when Solomon takes up in the first part of 2 Chronicles, once again, we don't read anything about his 1,000 wives. You do get the hint that he married a princess of Egypt and that he recognized that she couldn't stay in the palace because he wanted to keep it holy. But there's no talk about his wives tearing his heart away. There's no talk about the end of his life when he chased after things rather than God. Almost the entirety of what is shared of Solomon is his preparation and his building of the temple. In fact, as he builds the temple, it's kind of interesting because many secular readers would come to the conclusion that Solomon was just like everybody else. He knew that his God needed a place to live. May I suggest the temple wasn't built for God? It was built for the people to worship God. In fact, Solomon is very clear about that. He says in chapter 6, but will God really dwell on earth with men? The heavens, even the highest heavens, cannot contain you, much less this temple I have built. Yet give attention to your servant's prayer and to his plea for mercy. O Lord my God, hear the cry and the prayer that your servant is praying in your presence. May your eyes be open toward this temple day and night, this place on which you said you would put your name there. May you hear the prayer your servant prays towards this place. The temple was there so that Israel could have a place to worship God. I don't know if you've thought about this. One of the struggles I have in the Old Testament is, does God really care about the whole world or just Israel? As you read through the Old Testament, there's no doubt that the major emphasis is on Israel. And they're building a temple in Israel. It's just for Jews, right? If you continue down, Solomon throws out this entire section, that the temple was not originally built simply for Jews. He says, as for the foreigner who does not belong to your people Israel, but has come from a distant land because of your great name and your mighty hand and your outstretched arm, when he comes and he prays towards this temple, then hear from heaven your dwelling place and do whatever the foreigner asks of you, so that all the people of the earth may know your name and fear you as you do your own people Israel, and may know that this house I have built bears your name. God wanted Israel to reach the world. Israel got caught up in themselves. God desires the church to reach the world. I wonder if we don't suffer from many of the same struggles Israel did. But the temple is built, and we, a couple weeks ago when we were in 1 Kings, I threw this up, and if you haven't watched it, I'd encourage you to still go to it. It's just an animation that reads 1 Kings 6 and 7, and as the descriptions are shared, somebody has tried to create what it may have looked like, but I was just kind of curious. The temple, we're told, was 60 cubits by 30 cubits. I don't know about you, but that doesn't help me out a lot. Okay, I know a cubit's from the elbow to the tip of the finger. I know it's 18 inches. Okay, so that makes it 90 feet by 45 feet by 45 feet tall. That still didn't help me very much. So I went on Google, and I don't know if I should say we live in an amazing time or a scary time. You can go to Google Maps, and you can zoom in on a satellite and look at our building. And you can find out that our building is, I don't know, it's roughly 90 feet by 45 feet. Now, we're not 45 feet tall, so we're not quite as tall, but the temple was about the same size as our building. We don't have too many gold walls in the church. I'll give you that. So it maybe isn't quite as fancy. But the temple really wasn't this humongous building. It was a place for people to come. But how did that compare? The interesting part to me is that this is just one of, depending on what you want to do with the temple in the book of Revelations, 4 or possibly 5 temples that are mentioned. If you remember, God created told Moses to make the tabernacle, and as soon as the temple is done, the tabernacle is folded up and stored for the rest of its life inside the temple. But as we finished last week, that Solomon's temple will be destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, and it will be entirely damaged. And 70 years later, we'll see next week, Ezra and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel will come, and they will rebuild the second temple. There really are no descriptions of the second temple. We don't know how big it was, how small it was. We only know that those who saw Solomon's temple and those who saw this temple wept, because it certainly didn't have the appearance of Solomon's temple. But over the course of several centuries, that second temple will be made into a third temple. Rome will put Herod in charge of Israel, and because he was half Jew and half Edomites, the Jews didn't really respect him. And so the first thing he attempts to do is to build a brand new temple. And he basically levels the second temple, and he builds a third temple, and it's substantially larger. This is an artist's rendition, but the Herod's temple was magnificent. It was amazing. I don't know if it had as much gold as Solomon's temple, but it was certainly a sight to be seen until 70 AD. And then in 70 AD, the Romans will level the third temple, and to this day, there has not been any temples. But I believe it's tomorrow is Israel's 70th anniversary. And I don't know if you know this or not. You can talk to Paul, because he's done a lot of reading, and we've talked about it. There's actually a movement right now to build the fourth temple. In fact, I'm told that there is a group who's actually made an application to build the next temple. The book of Revelation will make mention of it. I don't know what happens to the fourth temple, but in Ezekiel, we get a description of at least a fourth, and possibly this is different than the one in Revelation. It's the millennial temple that will dwarf all the previous temples. But that temple only has a 1,000-year lifespan. Because at the end of the millennium, God will destroy heaven and earth, and then we will get a new temple. It will be Jesus himself. In fact, in Revelation chapter 21, we are told that he will be with us and there will be no need for the temple. But as the book of Chronicles is being written, the nation is looking back, seeing the first temple already gone, and wondering, how do we build that second temple? In the prayer of dedication, God responds in chapter 7 with what I would suggest is the theme to the rest of the book. In some regards, maybe even the rest of the Old Testament. God will say to Solomon as he's receiving the dedication, he will say, if my people who are called by name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. The first question that I have to ask is, who are these people he's talking about? Are we the people God is talking to? Well, in one sense, God made us. All of us bear the image of God. So in one regard, we are. But it seems very clear from the context that it is a specific people that God has called. Okay, then it's the church, right? Well, the problem with the church is the promise is that God will heal their land. The church doesn't own land. Now, I'm not talking about this body, but the church, capital C. We're international. We're in every country, hopefully in every language. We don't have the same privileges that Israel did. So do we just throw the verse out? I would suggest that what you find here is God's pattern for how all of us are to approach him. His pattern really is twofold. The first is the willingness to humble ourselves. It's not very easy for most of us. I can say that with absolute confidence because as you go through the book of 2 Chronicles, I think I came up with three names that at some point in their life don't get filled with themselves and exalt themselves. Humility is hard for all of us. But the key to entering God's presence is the willingness to humble ourselves and then to seek God with our whole heart, to cry out to him in prayer, to turn from the wickedness that we have been pursuing, and with all that we have, seek him. With all of that as my introduction, you have in your bulletin not a nice, neat outline. I tried to figure out how to outline the book, and instead I decided to go with squiggly lines and red and green names. You have the red names. Those are the evil kings. There's actually a total of, 19 kings and one queen, 12 of which get the description as evil. What's kind of interesting to me is if you go through the second two-thirds or three-quarters of the book, 30% will be spent on those 12 kings. 70% will be spent on the 8 good kings. And in fact, if you want to break it down, an even higher percent will be spent on 3 kings. Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah, and Josiah. But very quickly, let me see if I can run through these. Rehoboam begins, and he gets filled with his own wealth and says, Solomon may have had some things, but I'm going to have even more. And the kingdom is split, and Jeroboam splits the kingdom, and the son of Rehoboam is the first good king of the nation of Judah. Abijah is an interesting fellow. We don't have a whole lot about him, but we do read of a war that breaks out. As it breaks out, there's a civil war. Think of American history back in the 1860s. The North and the South, they split. We went to war. Thousands, tens of thousands of people died. That's what happens in Israel. Unfortunately for Israel, the North wins and stays separate. But in the midst of that, Jeroboam was a far greater tactician, a much better general than Abijah was. And there comes a moment that he lays an ambush, and suddenly he's surrounded by hundreds of thousands of soldiers. What do you do when you have no hope of victory? Judah turned and saw that they were being attacked both front and rear, and then they cried out to the Lord. The priests blew their trumpets, and the men of Judah raised the battle cry, and at the sound of their battle, God routed Jeroboam and all Israel before Abijah and Judah. The Israelites fled before Judah, and God delivered them into the hands, and Abijah and his men inflicted heavy losses on them, so that there were 500,000 casualties. I don't know that I could get my hands around that. That's the entire city of Des Moines gone. Why? Because Judah was victorious because they relied on the Lord, the God of their fathers. We then move to Asa, and Asa is the second good king. And Asa's an interesting fellow. He is not at war with Israel this time. He's at war with the Cushites, a country just to the west of Egypt. And Asa is suddenly overwhelmed, and he calls to the Lord, "Lord, there is no one like you. Help the powerless against the mighty. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rely on you, and in your name we have come against this vast army. O Lord, you are our God. Do not let men prevail." And I just love the way the chronicler states it. Asa doesn't win. Judah doesn't win. The Lord does. In fact, there's a tremendous victory, and Judah has this incredible chance, but I wish we had time, and we really don't have time, to look at the man Jehoshaphat. He's a fascinating individual. A couple of years ago, my wife did a kids program. Maybe you remember it. Something about fat Jehoshaphat. I don't remember this story, but it's Jehoshaphat is this amazing individual who is one of the few characters in the entire story that we don't read of him getting caught up in his arrogance. Now, he didn't always make great decisions, but I love in chapter 19, there's this fascinating story. He's overwhelmed by an army of Moab and Ammon. There's no hope for him. So he does what every good general would do. He says to the choir, "You guys need to stand in front of us." You know, sometimes these stories just kind of go over our heads. Imagine yourself, pick your favorite war. And the generals say, let's see, we're going to go with the infantry in front of them. We're going to go with the mechanized infantry tanks. And in front of them, choir boys, time for you to go first. How do you think that's going to work out? How do you think Jehoshaphat thought it would work out? I love verse 22. As they began to sing and praise, the Lord ambushes against the men of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir who were invading Judah, and they were defeated. The men in Ammon rose up against the men of Mount Seir to destroy and annihilate them. And after they had finished slaughtering the men from Seir, they helped to destroy one another. And when the men of Judah came to the place that overlooks the desert and looked towards the vast army, they saw only dead bodies lying on the ground. No one had escaped. So Jehoshaphat and his men went to carry off the plunder. And they found among them a great amount of equipment and clothing and also articles of value, more than they could have taken away. There was so much plunder that it took 3 days to pick it up. And the army didn't lift a bow, a sword, a spear. Amen. All they did was sing. We could continue, but one of the struggles with Jehoshaphat is he so longed to see the nation of Israel reunited that he foolishly got involved with the kings of Israel. In fact, he will give his son to marry one of Ahab and Jezebel's daughters. And there is these unhealthy alliances that really serve to bring great pain to Judah. In fact, Jehoshaphat's sons take them away from God. And in fact, as you come to Azariah, he just reigns for a few years, and you have one of the most bizarre stories, because his mom, I thought about preaching on this for Mother's Day, Queen Athaliah kills all her children. At least that's her intent. She so wants to be in charge, she's willing to kill her own kids. She misses one. And Jehoiada, the high priest, he keeps Joash protected for 6 years. They keep him in the temple. And when he's 7 years old, Jehoiada gathers the army together and he announces the king is in the temple. Athaliah rebels and the army goes out and kills her. And the story of Joash is scary to me. Because as long as Jehoiada, his spiritual mentor, is alive, he walks with the Lord. And then as soon as Jehoiada dies, he turns from the Lord. I hope you have spiritual mentors. I hope you have people that you look up to. I hope you have fathers and mothers in the faith, as it were. I hope that you have followed in the footsteps of someone. But what happens when they're gone? Joash didn't know what to do. We could continue to Amaziah was the next bad king. Uzziah and Jotham were two good kings that we don't really have time to look at. Ahaz becomes this horrific king. And then comes my favorite king. I've got 10 minutes to tell a 10-hour story. We'll see how it goes. Hezekiah is an amazing man. I actually had the chance, my very first sermon I ever preached was on the man Hezekiah. 2 Kings paints an interesting picture of Hezekiah. Isaiah paints an interesting picture of Hezekiah. The book of Chronicles has a completely different picture of Hezekiah. In fact, it's going to spend 3 chapters on Hezekiah, almost nothing of his economic development, nothing of his military prowess. It's entirely consumed with his worship and his restoration of the temple. In fact, it takes him weeks just to remove all of the altars and idols that the previous kings had brought into the temple. And as you come to chapter 30, he sends out this proclamation. Chapter 31 is a Passover feast. I don't know what you think when you read through the Old Testament. I've kind of always thought of Passover a little bit like Christmas. They spent an entire week to celebrate it. It was a national holiday. Everybody shut down. There was all of these incredible family gatherings and parties that you would go to, meals and fun. I always assumed they must have done that every year. We're going to find in Hezekiah that they haven't celebrated Passover for centuries. What do you think it would take to end Christmas in America? I recognize that Christmas is more secular than it used to be. But you can still go to most malls and stores and at least occasionally hear some of the good old spiritual Christmas carols. Can you envision a scenario in which nobody even remembers what Christmas was about? It's what's happened in Hezekiah's day. It's just gone. We don't celebrate it. We have nothing to do with it. God brought deliverance. Why should we remember that? Okay, God commanded us to observe it. We got better things to do. And Hezekiah, don't let this go over your head. It says he decided to send a proclamation throughout. As you come to the book of Chronicles, Judah and Israel are two different things. Israel is the 10 northern tribes. He decides he's going to send a proclamation from Beersheba. Beersheba is the southernmost city, the southern edge of Judah, to Dan, the northern portion of the 10 tribes. We talked about the importance of the genealogies last week, and the question is, why do they have to worry about it? There's only 2 tribes left. No, there's not. Hezekiah has already watched Sennacherib come through and carry off all of the 10 tribes, and yet there are few that remain. And he says, why don't you guys come celebrate with us? Why don't you return to your homeland? And as he sends these messengers out, these couriers out, some of them scorned them and ridiculed them. Nevertheless, some of the men of Asher and Manasseh and Zebulun, there's that word again, humbled themselves and went to Jerusalem. Also in Judah, the hand of God was on the people to give them unity of mind to carry out what the king and his officials had ordered following the word of the Lord. The first 2 chapters concerning Hezekiah is all about their willingness to humble themselves and to seek God. And that makes their life perfect, right? No problems whatsoever. There's nothing that can go wrong except for the most barbaric, most brutal general the world may have ever seen comes knocking. Sennacherib. Sennacherib was an incredibly barbaric man. We don't have time and I don't really want to go, but he was as brutal as anybody who's ever served in the army. And I find it really fascinating the way the chronicler shares the story. If you go to 2 Kings, there'll be an entire chapter about all of the insults that Sennacherib and his generals will hurl, the mockery of them and their God. The chronicler, Hezekiah and the prophet Isaiah, son of Amos, cried out in prayer to heaven about this. And then the Lord just sent an angel, annihilated all of the fighting men and the leaders of the officers in the camp of Assyria. So he, speaking of Sennacherib, withdrew to his own land in disgrace, and he went into his temple of his God, and some of his sons cut him down with a sword. 185,000 people gone because Hezekiah cried out to the Lord his God and never lifted a sword. Unfortunately, as great as Hezekiah was, as righteous and as passionate as he was about his service of God, Manasseh is the low point in Judah's history. If you study history, there's an intertestamental period between the end of Malachi and the beginning of the New Testament. And during that time, Antiochus Epiphanes will come, and he will commit what is called the abomination of desolation. He will take a pig and he will sacrifice it on the altar in Jerusalem. And it is an incredibly terrible act. But look what Manasseh does. This is a king of Judah. He builds altars in the temple of the Lord, which the Lord had said, my name will remain in Jerusalem. In both the courts of the temple, he built altars, not altar, altars to all the starry hosts. Manasseh commits the abomination of desolation. Himself, a follower of Jehovah. And God says, I've had enough. He sends word to Manasseh and his people, but they pay no attention. So the Lord brought against them the army commanders of the king of Assyria, who took Manasseh prisoner. If you go back and you can find some of the 5th and 6th century BC art of the Assyrians. And one of the most common images will be of individuals with their hands chained and a hook in their nose, as they drag them away like animals. What happens to Manasseh? They put a hook in his nose, they bind him with bronze shekels, and he took him to Babylon. But the reason I wanted to share this story of Manasseh, because as Manasseh is in Assyria, as he's being treated like an animal, he seeks the Lord and he humbles himself. And as he humbles himself, he prays, and what happens? If my people, who are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, I will forgive their sins, and I will heal their land. Manasseh was the worst king Judah would ever have. And yet when he humbled himself and he sought God, God forgave. Amen. There isn't a single one of us here who is anywhere close to where Manasseh was. I can confidently say, if you will humble yourself, turn from your sins and seek God, he will forgive. Amen. He will save. We don't really have time this morning to look at the rest of these stories. Josiah is an incredible individual, but after Josiah, you have this downward spiral in which four kings will cover a very short time. Nebuchadnezzar will come, and he will utterly destroy the city of Jerusalem. The nation of Judah ends. Very quickly, I did want to just share two thoughts with you this morning. The first is, starting well doesn't guarantee finishing well. In fact, if you look at the eight individuals who are called good kings, kings that worship the Lord their God, only three of them didn't run away from God at some point. In fact, Asa, I had mentioned in chapter 16, one of the more famous verses of 2 Chronicles, we read, the eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. You have done a foolish thing, and from now on you will be at war. And what is Asa, a good king's response? He has so wandered from the service of the Lord that he becomes angry at the prophet and throws him in jail. Where are you at in your spiritual walk? Yesterday's victories do not guarantee tomorrow's successes. In fact, the reality is that we are either moving closer to Christ every day or drifting further away. I think one of the things that all of us would be very wise to do is to just take a few moments and do a spiritual inventory. Am I more passionate about Christ today than I was last year, the year before? Am I consuming more of my time, energy, effort, and resources in the worship of my God? Or am I more caught up in the pursuits of this world and its pleasure? The story in 2 Chronicles is that even the great kings, even Hezekiah, this amazing man, sees God use him and thinks, oh, I must be doing pretty well. Look at all that I have done. And God says, no, you haven't, Hezekiah. Look at all I have done. But I think the overriding point to the book of 2 Chronicles is simply this. Humbleness and faith are always met with God's greatest blessings. I was thinking about this sermon. I end up, to some degree, living the passage for the week coming up. And this Wednesday, let me just back up a little bit. We've been talking for quite some time as a church about what God would have us to do with the space that we have. And every February we have a leadership retreat. And at the leadership retreat, as we were talking, it was concluded that it's time to decide and move forward or forget about it. It was suggested that we consider the idea of adding space. And so at the annual meeting, we voted to put a committee together to research and to bring a proposal in October. And that committee met for the first time on Wednesday night. Maybe I shouldn't confess my lack of faith sometimes. I start to hear numbers like hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I think, where is a church like Victor ever going to get that money? And as I was thinking of that, God takes the book of 2 Chronicles and smacks me up alongside the head and says, do you really think $500, $1,000, $1 million is too much for me? The question isn't, do you have the resources? The question is, are you willing to humble yourself and to seek me with all your heart? The question for us as a church is, are we willing to humble ourselves and pray and seek God's face? Or are we just going to plan and try and come up with the best way to raise the funds? I'm pretty confident that will fail. But I'm equally confident that if we are truly willing to humble ourselves and to seek God with all our heart, we will accomplish things way beyond anything we can imagine. Right. I have no idea what that will look like. But I do know the one who does. I want to challenge you for the next few months. Would you remember that committee? Remember this church? That we would be willing to put our eyes on God and do what he wants. Finances will be no problem. Father, I bow in your presence this morning, and I thank you for this incredible reminder that it's not about my efforts, it's not about my strengths. It's all about you. God, I do pray that we as individuals would make certain that we have humbled ourselves, that we have turned from our wicked ways, that we are pursuing you with all our heart. But I pray that we as a body, we as Victor Baptist Church, might unite around your will, whatever that may be. And then, God, I pray that we would always remember to praise and honor you, for you and you alone deserve it. For it is in your Son's holy and precious name we ask. Amen. Thank you so much for coming this morning.